Hello, we're ready to start session two. Again, we have nothing, well, we do have something to disclose. For those of you that might have been here, we're joint owners and consultants for Twin Solutions LLC, a firm that provides consultation and workshops related to cultural diversity. And the last thing we talked about, how diverse are you? And we want to now do what's called an up-down exercise, and Cheryl is going to lead you in that.
This is real easy, and it's one that you can modify and use easily. It's good. This is the one I told you that you could use as an icebreaker, but I saved it for when Carol's here. So all you have to do with any statement that you feel applies to you, please stand. Okay. You were born in North America. You were born in South America. Asia. Europe.
You're doing a lot of up-down, don't you?
Yes.
You have to slow down.
Okay. Australia. You were born in Africa. South Pacific. Central America. You are the oldest child. The youngest child. A middle child. The only child. You are married, single, divorced, separated, in partnership. You have children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren. I have a great-great-great niece. You are a nurse, social worker, nutritionist, public health professional, physician. Those of you that didn't stand, what are you? Student. Okay. You were the first in your family to attend college.
Is that the same as being the oldest?
No. No, your ancestry includes persons who are European. You might have to stand on more than one of these. African, Asian, Pacific Islander, Native American, Australian, North, South, or Central American. You grew up in a family that was socioeconomically average, above average, below average. You are Protestant, Catholic, Jewish, Buddhist, Muslim, agnostic, atheist, spiritual. Okay. Back. Okay. Diversity in public health practice.
This is really
sound. So you've shown that?
No.
Okay. So this, and I'll go through these quickly. This shows you the diversity in public health practice. Many times when we talk about black people, we think we're talking about one group of people, but we're talking about many different groups of people who have many, many different cultures, languages, values, beliefs. We're not talking about one group of people. Other diverse groups. Again, with Latino, Hispanic people, we're talking about many, many, and Asian, many different cultures, languages. Even when we talk about, and I'm from Alaska, out of about over 400 federally recognized tribes, about half of them live in Alaska. And they're very small groups, but over 200 groups. There are five or six major different language groups. and then many smaller language groups within that. So even in a very small population, you're talking about tremendous diversity, difference in food, difference in lifestyle, difference in language. All right, Carol, you want to do this?
I love this poem.
When I born, I black. When I grow up, I black. When I go in sun, I black. When I scared, I black. When I sick, I black. When I die, I still black. And you white fellow, when you born, you pink. When you grow up, you white. When you go in sun, you red. When you cold, you blue. When you scared, you yellow. When you sick, you green. And when you die, you gray. And you calling me colored? This was supposedly written by a South African child. But I love it. I love it. Let us now turn and talk about racism. We said we're going to talk about this. And as I said, many times we get emotional reactions when we see this word because we reject it. And we certainly don't want it applied to us. Racism is a specific form of oppression that encompasses economic, political, social, and cultural structures, actions, and beliefs that systematize and perpetuate an unequal distribution of privileges, resources, and power between whites and people of color. So it is a system. It is a white racial and cultural prejudice and discrimination supported intentionally or unintentionally by institutional power and authority, used to the advantage of whites and the disadvantages of people of color. The critical element that differentiates racism and race prejudice is institutional power and authority. And this is why many black scholars will argue people of color cannot be racist. I mean, can be racist in their attitudes, but they cannot deal in racism because they don't have the power to do so. So it's the, as we talked about before, it's the attitude and the action. People of color may hold prejudices toward whites, and many do, and sometimes are reluctant to admit it, but do not have the social and institutional power backing their prejudice that transforms it into racism. The impact of their prejudice on whites is isolated, temporary, and contextual. From a critical social justice perspective, when we say only whites can be racist, we mean only whites have social and institutional power and privilege. Now, there's such a thing as institutionalized racism, and I have some friends. One is from Zimbabwe. The other is Caribbean, and they have been doing research in Southern Africa on internalized racism. This is something a lot of people are researching right now. Internalized racism is the personal conscious or subconscious acceptance of the dominant society's racist views, stereotypes, and biases of one's ethnic groups. So you take into yourself, you internalize the racist attitudes that discriminate against your group. It gives rise to patterns of thinking, feeling, and behaving that result in discriminating, minimizing, criticizing, finding fault, invalidating, and hating oneself while simultaneously valuing the dominant culture. Internalized racism occurs when people targeted by racism are against their will, coerced and pressured to agree with the distortions of racism. Each of us targeted by racism fights from childhood on, as long and as hard as we dare, to maintain a sense of ourselves as good, smart, strong, important, and powerful. However, in our society, racist attitudes are so harsh, so pervasive, and so damaging that each of us is forced at times to turn racism in upon ourselves and seemingly agree with some of the conditioning internalizing the messages of racism. We come to mistreat ourselves and other members of our groups in the same ways that we have been mistreated as targets of racism. Internalized racism has been studied a lot in research, both in this country and abroad, and it has been associated with glucose intolerance among black Americans in the United States Virgin Islands, youth violence among African American males, glucose intolerance among African Caribbean women, negative effects on the mental health and identity development among Chicano and Latino college students, metabolic abnormalities among black women in Zimbabwe. And this is the research that my friends have done, Court and Gwebu. And they have looked at, and Toll, they have looked at glucose intolerance and various manifestations of diabetes among black women in Zimbabwe and found that it's directly correlated with internalized racism. So it has some physiological effects. Internalized racism has made us think of ourselves or each other as stupid, lazy, unimportant, or inferior, criticize or verbally attack each other using the racist messages of our society or allowing others to do so, physically attack or kill one another, gang violence, vulnerable to heart disease, high blood pressure, obesity, diabetes, HIV, AIDS, ulcers, and more, criticize and beat our children in misguiding efforts to discipline them, feel hopeless, despairing, and angry, which can make us vulnerable to the lure of alcohol and other drugs for relief, fight each other in gangs, feel disconnected from others, place higher values on members of our groups who appear more white and denigrate those who have darker skin, kinkier hair, smaller noses, less slanted eyes, or other less white features. And this is something that's in all groups. And things seem to get better among blacks during the civil rights era, but they reverse themselves. Look at the images of black people on television. In India, when we were there, I've been there a couple of times, if you look at Indian television, you would think everybody in India was my color. But they're not. Most people in India are my husband's color, and he's dark brown. But you never see those dark brown people on television. Never. And they are of the lower social caste. Because of internalized racism, various racial groups fight with each other over what seems like a scarcity of resources. So you have blacks fighting Hispanics, West Indians fighting American blacks. Some of our groups join racist institutions and take part in carrying out their racist policies against their own people. They have internalized self-hate. Here's a vignette. Laura Padilla reports a conversation with a college classmate who was delivering a harangue blaming the evils of the world on undocumented Mexican immigrants. I interrupted, she said, alerting him that I was Mexican-American. He hesitated momentarily and said, "But you're not a dirty Mexican," and continued his vitriolic diatribe. He assumed that she shared his negative stereotypes, and many times people in various groups will do this. And so she says, some Mexican Americans speak of Mexican immigrants as overconsuming public benefits, express fear about losing jobs to cheap immigrant labor. These are Mexicans talking. Latinos are also viewed as undeserving beneficiaries of preferences who are ignorant, lazy, and can barely speak English. They're considered to bring inferior cultural mores, including a propensity to go on welfare and commit crimes. They have poor health and hygiene, disregard for hard work and education, and a backward attachment to their language. I can't get over that one. The welfare stereotype persists, even though Latino men are employed at one of the highest rates of any population group. We also have what is called institutionalized racism. Here, we are looking at social patterns that have the net effect of imposing oppressive or otherwise negative conditions against identifiable groups on the basis of race or ethnicity. Because institutional racism is structural, there does need not to be an identifiable perpetrator. Examples include differential access to quality education, sound housing, gainful employment, appropriate medical facilities, a clean environment, material resources, wealth, representation in government, and control of the media. Institutionalized racism may explain the persistent association between race and socioeconomic status in this country. It is frequently subtle, unintentional, and invisible, but it's always potent. Often institutional racism involves complex and cumulative factors. For example, when many students of color year after year do not have access to fully credentialed teachers, high-quality curriculum materials, and advanced courses, and it's institutionalized. It's institutionalized in the budgets of cities and counties and states where certain communities get more money for education than others. So, person, you don't have to do anything to those kids individually that is racist. The institution has perpetuated patterns, and if you follow them, racist outcomes result. In the United States, institutional racism results from social caste system that sustained and was sustained by slavery and racial segregation. Although the laws that enforce this caste system are no longer in place, its basic structure still stands to this day. And the author Head says this may eventually fall apart, but action and advocacy are really necessary to bring about a more equitable society. So here's some examples. Opposing public school funding, not necessarily an act of individual racism. You may have feelings that it's not good, but one can certainly oppose public school funding for valid reasons. But to the extent that doing so has a disproportionate and detrimental effect on minority youth, it furthers the institutional racism. Most other positions contrary to the civil rights agenda, like opposition to affirmative action, which denies the historical nature of the disadvantages that many people of color face, support for racial profiling, and so forth, can also have the often unintended effect of sustaining institutional racism. And Cheryl's going to talk to you about oppression. Okay, oppression describes policies, practices, norms, and traditions that systematically exploit one group, a target group, by another, the dominant group, for the dominant group's benefit. The common elements of oppression are norms defined by the dominant group, institutional power that Carol just talked about, economic power, violence and the threat of violence, and target group invisibility. Another issue that we find when we look at patterns of injustice is this idea of privilege. Privilege refers to the rights, benefits, and advantages that are automatically received by being a member of a dominant group, regardless of intentions. From the critical social justice perspective, privilege refers to systemically conferred dominance and the institutional processes by which the beliefs and values of the dominant group are made normal and universal. In some cases, the privileged group is also the numerical majority, but it is not the key criterion. The key criterion is social and institutional power. So we can talk about male privilege. Males in this country are not the numerical majority, but they are the privileged group. A special case is white privilege. So this is an assertion that white patients, clients, students in your place of work suffer from white privilege. What is white privilege? Peggy McIntosh from Wellesley College defines it as an invisible package of unearned assets that a person can count on cashing in every day. An invisible, weightless knapsack of special provisions, assurances, tools, maps, guides, code books, passports, visas, etc., emergency gear, and blank checks. Those who are privileged rarely acknowledge and may even be unaware of its existence. They are unlikely to understand that unearned privilege is not a good thing for their development or that systems of privilege could ever be challenged or changed. Okay, examples of white privilege. And I'm going to put a lot of these here, and I'll just look at, if you look at Peggy's work, she gives about 37 different statements that you can make if you're privileged. You can read some of those. I can remain oblivious to the language and customs of persons of color who constitute the world's majority without feeling, in my culture, any penalty of such oblivion. Sometimes when I think about privilege, I think about being a twin. Sometimes people come up to me and say, what is it like to be a twin? You know, I want to say, what is it like not to be a twin? I'm unconscious of that. If you could define twinness as a privilege, which I do, I'm unconscious of that. You know, I don't even think about it. And that's how privilege operates. You don't even have to think about it. Some other examples. My culture gives me little fear about ignoring the perspectives and powers of people of other races. I can be pretty sure finding people would be willing to talk with me and advise me about my next steps professionally. I can be late to a meeting without having the lateness reflect on my race. So if you go through Peggy's work, White Privilege and Male Privilege, she will give you these questions to think about it. It's for many of us, it's unconscious. Also out of this kind of idea of privilege, we have internalized dominance. And this is internalizing and acting out the constant messages that you and your group are superior to the target group. And this entitles you to your privilege position. These include rationalizing privileges as normal, rationalizing privilege as earned, perceiving you or your group as most qualified for and entitled to the best jobs, living your life segregated from the target group, yet feeling no loss or desire for connection with them in such instances as white flight.
lacking an interest in the perspectives of the target group, except in limited and controlled doses, such as during ethnic weeks or holidays, such as Chinese New Year, when it appears to benefit the dominant group, as in, I want my child to experience diversity. Feeling authorized to debate or explain away the experiences of target groups. Oppression differs from discrimination, bias, prejudice, or bigotry because these refer to individual acts that anyone can manifest. In contrast, oppression occurs when prejudice is backed by social and institutional power. Oppression involves institutional control, ideological domination, and the imposition of the dominant group's culture on the target group. Prejudice plus power equals oppression. Individuals can belong simultaneously to both dominant and target groups. So you can be a white woman and belong to both dominant and target groups. So we have to kind of look at our own experience. Where do we fall in this? When race becomes an issue. When a person of color brings up race as an issue, listen deeply. If the person indicates that he or she is offended, don't be defensive. Do not begin talking quickly. Stop and think first. Stop and listen. Stop and feel. Do not explain why they are misrepresenting the situation. Do not begin crying. This is an infuriating response to people of color. I can't tell you. Don't cry. If you hear something third hand, don't get angry. Remember that it is almost never completely safe for a person of color to challenge a dominant perception. Cultural values have to do with what is judged good or bad, right or wrong by a culture. They represent what is expected or hoped for, required or forbidden. Values are not behaviors themselves, but are the criteria, the basis by which behavior is judged and sanctions applied. To know that a person comes from a certain ethnic background does not tell us where they fit in terms of values or behaviors. Rather, it alerts us to possible arenas of miscommunication. We can then observe more carefully to see where that individual fits on a continuum of values compared to his or her ethnic group. You've probably seen these kinds of charts before that compare white American cultural values to the values of people of culture as a way of pointing out some of the areas where we need to think about how we're relating to people across cultures. So for white Americans, mastery over nature is important. You know, we didn't get the notion that we as Americans, black or white, we're not in control of nature until the whole notion of postmodernism replaced our notions of certainty with science. You know, science gave us great certainty during the modern period. Now people said science didn't work, but we thought we could control nature. Now look what's happened to us with the natural disasters that we have actually caused by thinking that we're controlling nature and doing whatever we wanted to with it. People of color are likely to emphasize harmony with nature. Think about the American Indian view of nature as part of themselves and that they are part of nature and that they've got to be in harmony with nature and protect it. Doing is really important for white American culture, where being, you know, the person, the internal person, is much more important to people of color. Time dominates, use every minute. As opposed to interpersonal interaction dominates, time is always with us. So we talk about Hispanic people and they talk about time as walking. We talk about time as racing. You talk to African people and they're focused in the past. So to them, the most important time element for them is the past. They value old people, they value their history, they value their ancestors, and they say that they are waiting for time. We never say that. Individualism and privacy. This is a very important cultural value. Group welfare. You look at people from Asia where the group is more important than the individual. And sometimes we have a hard time understanding that. And they have a hard time understanding us for that very reason. What's more important, the individual or the group? Competition is very important to Americans. Cooperation is more important to many other cultures. Directness, openness, and honesty.
very important to white Americans were indirectness, ritual, and face. And we talked a little bit about indirection before, this notion of face. And so you will never be really confrontive of a person because you're destroying their face in many cultures, Middle Eastern cultures, African cultures, Native indigenous cultures in this country. Active versus passive. And many times we'll say, well, this person is passive. They're not doing things. They're not initiating things. We say that about our students and our patients. Work for the sake of work as work for current need. And so we say these people are really lazy. They just work for what they need. So they're present oriented. Work becomes an important issue. What is the meaning of work? You know, people that are from cultures where they can go out and pick their food off the tree all during the year have a different view of work than people that live in a climate where they have to work hard to get it. Theoretical versus pragmatic. So much more idealistic and theoretical in terms of our perspective as white Americans, as opposed to people of color, where we're much more pragmatic. What works? Verbal as opposed to nonverbal. Practicality and efficiency are highly valued as opposed to idealism. So we say these people are dreamy and they're not really paying attention to reality. Verbal skills as opposed to listening and observation skills. So people are much quieter in many cultures than we as Americans are. Much more likely to listen and listen closely. And if you've ever had a deep conversation with people, I know I've had deep conversations with some of my friends from various countries in Africa, and they will listen to what you say and give you a detailed analysis of what you really said. Now, Proverbs highlight cross-cultural differences and conflicts. For instance, white Americans, one of the, you've seen this, haven't you, before? Squeaky wheel gets the grease. Okay, this is the value of aggressiveness. You know, I'm going to take charge. Direct confrontation. Might makes right. Heard that one? Okay. Dominance. Might makes right. That's how we enacted manifest destiny across this country as it developed. African Americans, don't air your dirty laundry. What does that mean? You know what that one means? What does it mean?
Keep it in the family.
Keep it in the family. Don't tell your business. Keep family matters private. Here's one from Senegal. Misunderstandings do not exist. Only the failure to communicate does. So strive to understand the other person's point of view. Harmony and balance is the normal state, not conflict and confrontation. That's see how we can work things out. Now, here's a proverb exercise. Write a proverb that is unique to your ethnic, racial, or cultural group. So I want you to divide up into little groups. Have you got a piece of paper? I'll give you some. And just write one proverb that your group tends to, back there. We got the old junky leftover, use the backs. We're being conscious, we're being green conscious. So we got some leftover announcements of the leg breaker. So write a proverb that is unique to your group and then exchange the proverbs within your group and read them aloud and briefly discuss the value suggested by each proverb. And then after you've discussed the proverb, tell whose proverb it is and clarify what it means to you and your ethnic group. So you're going to write down the proverb, you're going to pass them around to each other, and each one read one and talk briefly about what it means, and then the person that really wrote it, tell what it actually means in your culture.
Thank you.
So then we're supposed to get in a group?
Yes. Get in a group and pass them around. Did you talk to Linda?
Thank you.
Okay, did you learn anything from Proverbs about culture? Let's get back together. We've had all kinds of conversations. I've heard of all kinds of interesting things. Okay. Carol has a whole list of Proverbs from around the world. And if you, can we put those on the web? Okay, she had some problems with switching from cell phones and lost some of them, but I think I might have them. But if we still have them, I will put them on the if you send us your email address, we'll send you those proverbs. They're very interesting to see proverbs from around the world. Okay, dimensions of sexuality. This is an area of cultural difference that I want to talk about for a couple of reasons, but I'll talk about it and then I'll tell you why I want to talk about it if you can't figure it out. Okay, gender identity. So there are two pieces of sexuality. One is gender identity, and this is the gender with which a person identifies. And the second is sexual preference or orientation, and this is the object or objects of sexual attractiveness for a person. So when you talk about sexuality, you're talking about two different things. Gender identity. And we're not talking about biology here. We're talking about identity and preference and orientation. Okay, cross-cultural concepts of sexuality. While many Americans conceive of only two genders, male and female, and three sexualities, heterosexual, homosexual, and bisexual, historically and transculturally, multiple manifestations of both of these categories exist. Terms such as transgender and transsexual are used to refer to statuses that go beyond the usual concepts. In other cultures and among indigenous and immigrant groups in this country, socially integrated and accepted ways of expressing gender identity and/or sexual preference may be found. Back in Alaska, there are many, many people from the South Pacific. You wouldn't believe it. They come from those warm climates to live in Alaska. So we have a huge community of people from Samoa and numbers of people from Tonga. I am very good friends of a family from Samoa. The youngest son of that family, when I first met him, and they came to our church, the young men and the married couples would sit on one side and the young women would sit on the other side. He would sit with the young women. Sometimes he would carry a purse. Unlike his older brothers, who were in the military and they had their hair cut short, he let his hair grow long, and sometimes he'd have it pinned up or whatever. It was beautiful, but he let his hair grow long. And at one point, one person from the church said to him, "Why do you carry a purse?" And he told him that in his culture, he was identified as a woman. And I later found, and he was also a student at the university, very bright student, and actually got a fellowship to do research. He is what is known of in Samoan culture as a fa'afini. And that was a person who was raised, a young man who was raised by the mother to enact the role, the gender role of a woman. And the role in theirs, and this is well accepted and integrated into their culture. These individuals then provide care for children in the family, and they provide care for the parents when they're older. But they, and in their traditional culture, these people, I think, essentially don't marry, expected to be asexual, essentially asexual. And, but they, in spite of the fact that they're biologically male, they enact the role of a female and can dress like a woman. They associate with women. That's why he sat with his sisters instead of his brothers in church. We have no such category in this country. In some places in Europe, in Eastern Europe, there are women who legally change their status to that of a male, and they do it so that they can go into business or whatever, and they call them, not statutory virgins, but it's something like that. Again, these people are not expected to marry. They begin to wear men's clothes. They're referred to and treated in their communities as males. And what this allows them to do is to enact, certain social roles, business roles, that as women they would not be able to do. Again, we have no such classifications in our culture. So in addition to thinking that Two-Spirit people that among the American Indians, who essentially are people that we would call homosexual, but are honored and respected in their culture and expected to have great spiritualism, the same kind of thing we saw when we were in India. So they have Hijara? I'm trying to remember the name. But they were men who essentially dressed as women, and they would come to weddings and
participate
in religious activities. This was a well-defined status within that culture. It wasn't denigrated, stigmatized, persecuted in the way that such people might be in this country. One of the things that we need to think about is that sometimes we are so caught up in our own culture that we look upon other cultures as having all kinds of elements that are analogous to ours. And we don't realize that they can be much richer, have more categories that we have never even thought of. I used to tell people, Hanukkah is not the Jewish Christmas. Hanukkah is an entirely different holiday. You know, but it's that we superimpose our cultural structures on other people's cultures. So I think this is a good way to think about this. It's fascinating to read about the many, many different sexualities and genders that we can see across cultures. Cultural commonalities. All groups need acceptance and respect. They need for their culture to be known and acknowledged. They need it to be realized that they can learn and even excel given adequate time and appropriate learning environments. Here's another case study. This is a true case study, and one that we're in the midst of right now. I was fortunate to go last year to the World Federation of Public Health Associations meeting, at which I heard a young man who's from an Arab culture, I don't know which, but I know from his name he's from an Arab culture, talk about phosphide medications. He's a lawyer. He teaches in Canada in schools of medicine and law, and he's very interested in the whole issue of falsified medications and how people are harmed by that, and also trying to push for legislation, and he's kind of in the forefront of this movement, to push for international legislation to criminalize this so that people that actually falsify and market falsified medicines across many different countries can be apprehended, because as it stands now, no country has laws that will allow someone from another country who's perpetrated these kinds of crimes to be prosecuted. So after hearing him speak, I went up to him and encouraged him to come and speak, which he did. He just spoke at the Late Breaker here, and tried to get him to also write a policy proposal to go for the Governing Council at the Late Breaker, because apparently some of this international legislation is moving ahead as we speak, and he wanted, and I said, well, this would be a nice thing for APHA to get behind. And so Carol and I had worked with him on getting the proposal written. He was supposed to have turned it in Saturday evening by 6 o'clock. He went on the APHA website. There were some there was some inaccurate information about the time, the date of, you know, the time, date of turning it in, which made him think that it wasn't a big deal about when that got in. Which is a very big deal when you get things into the JPC. I'm a former coach, I know that. So he didn't get it in on time, and so then they wrote him back and said, we will not, you know, unfortunate, you know, we're not going to do this. And then he wrote back and said, well, I'm a lawyer, and now you didn't, you, this is what you said on your website wasn't accurate. I wrote you and you didn't get back to me. And, you know, they said, this is unfortunate that there was an error, but, you know, you should have known, and everyone knows that the, this is the time for the JPC submission. Everybody knows this, and you, and it can't happen. So when I kind of picked up on this conversation on Sunday morning, I was horrified. So I tried to work with them, and it was, you know, we have to adhere to our deadline. Were there other? I'm trying to remember what else was said.
Okay. I guess there was this back and forth between him and APHA staff. Mm-hmm. And the thing that struck me most was what Cheryl already said. The response was, everyone knows that this is what we do. Now, this is a new member. He's Canadian. He's from an Arab country. He belongs to the Canadian Public Health Association.
They he belongs to this one, too.
Now he belongs to this one. He's our new member. And this is what was said to him. Everyone knows, and you, dummy, should know this, too. Why didn't you do what you were supposed to do? And so we were horrified. He became very incensed. Now, I'm the co-convener of the late breaker session where he's going to present. He then said to them, okay, I'm a lawyer. I'm going to handle this like a lawyer. I'm supposed to go and speak at the late breaker, and instead of giving my presentation, I'm going to spend the whole 15 minutes telling how wrong your process is and rallying support for what I'm doing, and you know, telling people this is what we need to do. So we're in a quandary, you know. How are we going to calm him down? How are we going to save the late breaker session? I can imagine him haranguing the whole audience for 15 minutes. So anyway, we said, calm down. So then Cheryl steps in and did.
I wrote to the interim executive director and said, I realize that, you know, that this process, you know, I was a former co-chair of the JPC. I realized the importance of the process and whatever, but this is a new member, and here's a person who could be a productive and active member of the association, and what could we do? Now, maybe instead of breaking up, I'll just ask you from the floor.
Yes.
What are the cultural issues that are involved in this kind of a situation? What are the things that you would be thinking about, given the players? Well, when I questioned it, the staff members, I mean, the interim director said to me, the staff member consulted with the three co-chairs of the JPC before sending, you know, deciding not to let this go forward, yeah.
Well, I mean, you identified different categories of things, so I suppose he could have responded from an Arab culture perspective, a Canadian culture perspective, mm-hmm. a male culture perspective. But he chose to respond to the lawyer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So he had some options, mm-hmm. and for whatever reason, the one felt the most right for him.
Tell that he mentioned face.
And I don't know if that's a free
okay. What? There was some incorrect information on the website. Oh, the other thing that he said, and one of his. Messages to the JPC and the staff was, here is a way to save face, which was very interesting to me. He said, here's a way to save face in this situation. When I just saw and I just left him, you know, I asked him about one of the issues that I thought that probably, certainly, was this whole issue of time and scheduling. And, you know, he coming from a Middle Eastern, probably, culture, some Arab culture, or North African, I'm not sure which. Me coming from a Black American culture, where relationships always supersede time, issues. You know, what I was trying to gently say to the JVC was, look, here is a young man who could be a good member for us. He's very bright. He's at the forefront of this issue, important issue. It's an important public health issue. There are over 700,000 deaths every year as a result of falsified medications. He's a lawyer. He works with the medical school. He's obviously committed to public health. He's a good member. Do you want him to get off to this kind of a start with the association? So I tried gently to appeal to that. In some cultures, that would have been the overriding concern, not whether or not you missed the timetable.
Well,
but
I'm going to make a guess that he's young, a little bit younger maybe than I am. And
yes.
I know this with my younger than I am.
Okay.
And I know this with my children that they do believe that it's on the website exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a growing cultural divide, at least between me and my kids. And so I would hesitate to say to him, everyone knows that what's on the web isn't true, but it's been down that road. But that is a growing cultural difference.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah.
Silly.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I feel like it's more of an issue of access, right? I mean, like, if everyone knows this, like, as a young person and as a new person to engage, I mean, like, it's a pretty inaccessible conference, honestly. And so, I mean, like, I think that's really the issue as well, like, in addition to the issue of time, things like that, also an issue of access and an issue of institutionalized knowledge that isn't accessible.
No. No. And, yes, and I think.
I was just going to say that one of the things that I remember from very early cross-cultural training that I went to, which was probably 20 years ago now, really do go back to this issue of time and kind of the Northern European overlay that is the United States culture.
Mm-hmm. This is just energy. I'll maybe let you know what happens. It's okay, Mark Twain. I'm sorry. It'll probably now have to go to the executive board. So, because it's too late because they're out of the JPC process, so it can't go to the governing council now. Mark Twain once commented, "Whenever you find yourself on the side of the majority, it's time to pause and reflect." Recommendations. Embrace and celebrate the concept of difference among administrators, colleagues, students, clients, and patients. Advocate diversity with public health organizations and agencies and with educational institutions. Okay, I wanted to also bring up while we're doing the recommendations, a recommendation that Gene Swinney gave, and that is this whole idea of that has been a source of great distress, I think, to many of us, certainly I know to Gene, but also to me. And that is, well, I think many of us, and that is the nature of some of the textbooks that teach or purport to teach cultural diversity. and many of them do tremendous harm. I remember when I was, Carol had clued me into a course that the Cincinnati Children's Memorial Hospital did on genetics for nurses. It was an online course. It was excellently done. It was done on Blackboard. It was an 18-week course. She took it, and then she encouraged me to take it. And by and large, it was certainly a tremendous learning experience, and they did beautiful work with Blackboard. So I would encourage you, if you have students or you yourself are interested in genetics, it's wonderful. The only thing that was jarring was the section when they wanted to talk about cultural diversity in genetics. And they divided us into groups, and they purposefully gave us cultures that were different from our own. So I think I did a Jewish culture, and then they had some women that had read the stuff on African American cultures, and then we were supposed to get together online and discuss in groups what we had learned and share with each other. The things that those women got from that reading on African American cultures horrified me. I could not identify my own culture in some of the stuff that was on there. It was terrible. And I told the faculty, you have got to get rid of this textbook. It's awful. But many of them are. I think one of the things that gives problems is that many of the textbooks try to describe every culture. And they do it in such a short and many times inaccurate way, and also fall into the trap of, yes, they're stereotypical, and they also fall into the trap of thinking that any given person is a perfect exemplar of their culture, and that's not so. Instead of helping people understand how you understand and assess where the individual person and family are in relationship to their culture, you know, they said they attempt to describe in a shorthand. I mean, they had black people all superstitious. They were all dealing with voodoo. I couldn't believe it. I said, this has nothing to do with me. But this was how that textbook was. So you have to be very, very careful. The other thing is with people that do training. A multicultural training team came to us when I was at Rush in Chicago, and they were so horrendous in their descriptions of various cultures. Even one of my white faculty members couldn't take it. She had to go out. She said, it's too horrendous. And we talked to them at the break and said, and they tried to fix it, but you have to be very, very careful about how that gets done. Students have told me as I've gone around consulting that faculty are trying to teach them about culture, but sometimes they're very insensitive. They don't, instead of listening to the students, they are reading some of these textbooks, and then the students said they're telling us things that aren't right, or they're even talking about such things as health disparity and social determinants of health. I know one group of black students said to me, everything about us is wrong. We've got this problem, we've got that problem. I think the faculty was trying to tell them about health disparities, but the way they were doing it was putting the students down, and they were perceiving that as we're all wrong. Yeah.
Presentation on nursing theories. And after she left, I looked at my students.
look.
I never even thought of that before.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
It's much more covert, I think, than we think it is.
Let me just say one thing. I taught and created courses in transcultural nursing, several different graduate programs and undergraduate. And I was unable, based on my review of many of the nursing textbooks in cultural diversity, to use any of them. And what I would usually use, especially with my graduate students, was a book that was written by a medical anthropologist, and he just gave research. Because I found, in fact, one of the books was so bad that was sent to me for review that I wrote a letter to the publisher and said, what in the world? So be careful of that and encourage your students and you yourself, validate. You know, if you read something in a book and you say, oh, this is the gospel, it probably isn't. Talk to someone in the culture and validate, is this really true? And I think we need to do a lot more of that, but again, it depends on relationships. Do I have people that I feel comfortable and who feel comfortable with me, that we can talk about what it is that really characterizes the culture. What do things actually mean?
We need to hurry. Okay, we're going to... Yeah, the cultural humility, and you probably talked about it during the first session. If you would see me after, I can talk to you a little bit about that. But that is it's like death and dying. You never really finish dealing with that. It's something you have to keep revisiting. And culture is the same way. You've got to keep revisiting your own feelings, your own culture, your own perceptions and reactions to the cultures of others, and you've got to keep learning. It's a lifelong process. It's not something that you suddenly arrive at. It's something that you... Yes, I know. Right, yes. And most do not do it. And that is why we have the problems that we have, that we talked about earlier in agencies and in hospitals. Yes. Okay. Use inclusive language. Avoid stereotyping. Ask rather than assume. Accommodate diversity in student-teacher interactions, provider-client interactions, collegial interactions. Okay, now we're going to finish with a serial testimony exercise that Carol's going to describe.
Okay. The reason why this session was actually started was because of some issues that we had as public health nurses in our section related to how we relate to each other cross-culturally. So what we're going to do now is something that is going to try to help us at least to begin a conversation, because we don't have enough time to finish it, but we want to begin a conversation. And we're going to do this by serial testimony exercise. So what I want us to do is, as soon as I finish talking, I want all the public health nursing section people to go over to themselves. And what we're going to do is give some of you, because we're probably not going to give all of you an opportunity, here are the ground rules. Listen to each other with respect without interrupting to comment or ask questions. Speak about your own thoughts, reactions, feelings, and experience, not those of others. And during your turn, do not comment on what others have said before you. So I want all the public health nursing people to go together. And your question is, what is the real issue with regard to the cultural distance and the cultural dissonance that we are experiencing in the section? I want you to be honest. Each person can only talk for 1 minute. And so I'm going to use a talking stick, and it's going to be...
Can you say it again?
What do you actually attribute to? What do you attribute the cultural difference and dissonance? What is going on in the section, in other words, with regard to our cross-cultural communication? Now, we're going to use a talking stick, and it's this paper clip. So whoever has the talking stick can talk, but they can only talk for 1 minute or less. So get together as public health nurses. I want you to be honest with each other and obey the ground rules. Everybody else, move over to another section, and we're going to give you another question. But let me get these public health nurses started so they'll get going.
I'm going to put those guidelines about when race is an issue back up for you to consider as you talk.